Welcome to the Conceive Baby podcast. My name's Tasha Jennings, fertility naturopath and nutritionist. In each episode, I share with you my best fertility tips and introduce you to world-leading fertility experts to help you improve your fertility well-being to create your healthy pregnancy. Welcome to this episode of the Conceive Baby podcast. I'm fertility naturopath and nutritionist Tasha Jennings. And today I'm speaking with a wonderful guest. And together we are going to delve into the world of embryos and those really early stages of life creation. You know, what really happens when egg and sperm meet? How does fertilization occur? Why do some eggs fertilize yet not continue to grow? What is a blastocyst? And how does this differ from an embryo? How and when does implantation occur? We'll be answering all these questions and more with someone who really knows embryos inside out, and that is Lucy Lines. Lucy Lines is a clinical embryologist. Her career began with Monash IVF in Melbourne, and she has since worked in Sweden, the UK, Ireland, Germany, and then back to Australia to manage the lab for Monash IVF Queensland. Lucy has also been through her own fertility journey, trying for 7 years to conceive a sibling for her daughter through multiple miscarriages, then conceiving her son naturally at 43. Lucy understands the who, what, where, why, and how of fertility and IVF, and she's passionate about educating and supporting others through their journey through her company, Two Lines Fertility. Welcome, Lucy.
Thank you. My gosh, I feel like I need to almost take a bow or something.
You do. I think that's a pretty good record there.
A lot. It sounds like a lot. I'm tired.
Well, as I said, you do know embryos and this field inside out, and it can be an overwhelming journey when we go from trying to get pregnant naturally, thinking it's going to happen because that's what we're told. It's so easy to fall pregnant. So obviously we're going to fall pregnant easily. And then we get thrust into this world that, you know, year 10 biology does not cover.
No.
So
it turns out putting condoms on bananas is not as useful as some people thought it might be.
Absolutely. We literally learn nothing about these things. And so we go from, you know, this really unknown into this unknown world, and it's overwhelming, emotional, confusing. So you really help people, I guess, decipher and understand that journey. So how did you start? What got you into this?
It's something that sort of happened organically over my career. So while, you know, when you're at a party, you're at a dinner party, you're in the pub, you're wherever, people say, what do? You say, I'm an embryologist. They say, what's that? And you start, you know, I got to the point where I was saying to people, oh, I'm a scientist. Oh, research or clinical? Clinical. Oh, what kind of science? Oh, I'm an embryologist. Oh, what's that? Oh, I play with sperm and eggs and make embryos and help people get pregnant. Oh, and off it goes. And suddenly everyone's got all these questions and they want to understand more, and they've got a friend or an auntie or a cousin or, you know, whatever, who's had IVF. And so I guess through my clinical career, it was something that just kind of happened organically. Over that time of working in the clinical side of things, I met my husband and I moved to Sweden, and I ended up taking a job with a company that make products for IVF clinics. So I moved away from the actual clinical aspect of making embryos and was dealing with the IVF clinics from that point. And at that point, I realized just how big business this industry really is. You know, the industry of IVF is massive. And I thought it became more and more obvious to me over that time that there was a real gap in there from the people that I was meeting at dinner parties 20 years ago to these doctors and scientists and nurses who are amazing people. And in the middle there's there's a big gap for people who are listening to this podcast, probably exactly like these people who are sitting on their sofa feeling like they're going to get pregnant next month, and in the blink of an eye they find themselves in their fifth cycle of IVF and they still don't really understand how they got there. And I guess I just saw a need to fill that gap and to try and help people understand what they could do about their natural fertility, and if they did end up having IVF, why that was, and how to understand the process and how that would benefit from them, really.
Which is so, so important. Mm. I know I spoke with Dr. Kerry Hampton, and her research showed that only 13% of people attending IVF clinics actually knew their fertile window well. Yep. So we, as I said, we don't get taught this information. We don't get taught how to fall pregnant. So,
and there's a big gap there. You know, you're sitting on your sofa and everyone around you is having babies and you feel like it should be your turn any minute. So you go to your GP, which is fine. That's a good thing to do. And your GP, probably only 5% of GPs actually do any kind of any extra learning in women's health and fertility. So depending on who your GP is, they're likely to request some blood tests and tell you to come back in a couple of months, bargaining on the fact that most people will actually conceive naturally in those first 12 months. So they're really stalling for time. And then when you go back and you're not pregnant, the next thing they do is refer you to a fertility specialist. And depending on who they refer you to, some fertility specialists, and I'm absolutely never going to name anyone, but some fertility specialists are so hounded by the business aspect of these businesses that they work within that they have quotas that they have to meet, and they are rushed and busy and flat out, and they just don't have time. And they go, oh, well, you've been trying for 12 months, let's do IVF. And you're doing IVF. And no one in the middle has actually talked about, let's think about fertile window, let's think about the 90 days before conception, let's talk about sperm and parameters that we can't look at on a semen analysis, let's look at all these other things. And then if we end up at IVF, that's fine, but we know why we're there and we're prepared and we're ready.
Absolutely. I think we're definitely on the same page there. I work with some amazing specialists and they do an amazing job. However, there's a lot of patients that come to me and I say, why are you doing IVF? Well, because we hadn't conceived. I say, okay. So and let's work for 3 months and, hey, we get a natural pregnancy. I've had some people through multiple failed cycles, as you probably have as well, 7 rounds of IVF, and we get a natural pregnancy because we fix the things that were wrong. So IVF is an amazing technology. It gets people pregnant who would otherwise not be able to have children. It's absolutely wonderful. However, it's only as good as the egg and sperm.
All of that natural stuff that we do is preparing for conception. And if we spend 3 months doing all of that preparing for conception and natural conception still hasn't happened, then we have a choice. Do we do another 3 months or another couple of weeks or another couple of months or whatever, or do we then move to IVF? But if we then move to IVF, that doesn't mean we've given up on anything. It might mean that the problem lies further down the stream than that we can see without doing IVF. So we need to do IVF to gather more information about what might be going wrong. But the lab can only make beautiful embryos out of good raw materials. And, you know, it's not necessarily something you're doing wrong or any one thing that you're eating or drinking or not eating or exposing yourself for. You know, there's no one thing that's causing you not to get pregnant, but it's a process of preparation. And being an embryologist and an IVF scientist, I think that everybody should spend 3 months preparing for IVF, because then when you have IVF, hopefully you only need one or two cycles, not 7 or 8 or 10, because we've prepared the raw materials such that we've got the best we can possibly work with in the lab.
Let's get the flag out for that. Yep. That's probably my number one referrals is from IVF clinics who haven't, but they get them afterwards. Okay, we haven't had successful outcomes. Can you help them prepare for the next round so they might get a better success?
No, can we do this first?
Can we do this first?
Can we do this bit first, things? Yeah.
So let's talk about this first bit. Yep. You know, what are we talking about? There's lots of different terminologies in that when we delve into this world, but what are we talking about when we have eggs? You know, where do they come from? How many do we have? Do we run out? What are we talking about with the eggs in our body?
So we're born with all the eggs we'll ever have. We actually have the most eggs we'll ever have about 3 months before we're born, which when we're thinking just about ourselves, is, you know, we look back at our mothers and think, okay, so we were born with all those eggs, and the quality of those eggs is dependent on what our mothers were doing when they were pregnant with us. But we should also look forward and think, okay, well, when I get pregnant, which it's most likely that you will, because most people do eventually, if you're having a daughter, by the time she's born, she's got half your grandchildren on board. So, you know, it's a whole of life sort of thing, this preparation of eggs. So when we talk about eggs, we have quiet eggs. Quiescent is the scientific term, but it sounds like quiet, so I say quiet. Sitting quietly in your ovaries, doing nothing at all. They emit a very small little hormone called AMH, which lots of people will have heard of, because you get your AMH tested often in a workup, anti-Müllerian hormone. And those eggs just sit quietly in your ovaries and do nothing at all. You do lose some through childhood, but not many. And then when you get to puberty, each time you ovulate, you've actually recruited anywhere between 40 and 100 eggs to get one egg available to ovulate. So each time you ovulate one egg in the middle of your cycle, so halfway between your period, well, it's not always halfway, but for most people it's somewhere around about halfway between your two period, between two periods. When you ovulate that one egg actually was recruited for that job of ovulation, if you like, 3 months before that ovulation. And it was recruited together with an entire cohort of eggs, anywhere between 40 and 100. And all of the others die out bar that one that gets ovulated. Do we run out? How many do we have? Millions, hundreds of thousands of lots of. Unable to count. We lose, as I said, anywhere up to 100 each time we ovulate, and we batch cook our eggs. So they're sitting in our ovaries quietly, and then they sort of notice your brain telling sending signals that we need an egg to ovulate in 3 months' time. A group of them apply for the job and start, you know, going through the recruitment process towards that ovulation, and then you just get one ovulated. When we do IVF, we jump in a bit before that and then try and keep more of that cohort growing if we can. But basically, we have lots and lots of eggs. They're sitting in your ovaries doing nothing at all until, for some reason, sometime they start to notice the messages from your brain and grow up towards an ovulation.
Yeah. I love that we, as women, we refine and we refine and refine. We spin out that best egg, and it is always the best egg. And that's always, I'll let people know about IVF too. If that best egg wasn't going to be good enough, then we could collect 15 and we're not going to get there. So we really need to focus on that best egg, because biology is pretty smart.
Biology is sort of smart, but it's also a bit dumb sometimes. Like Why would we just have one? That seems really silly.
It'd be nice if we could give ourselves more chances.
Yeah, and how do you know? I'm not confident that recruitment process is excellent, and I'm not confident that you know, when you apply for a job, there's almost always a number of applicants for that job who shouldn't have bothered applying, and they were never going to be any good at the job, but in the job recruitment situation, you've only got one job, so you can only give one job. And the same in natural ovulation, you know, there's only one egg to be ovulated. But in IVF, what we're doing by gathering more of them is we're hoping that there were more than one applicants for the job who might have all been good at it.
And more that prep's better, chance we've got those.
We can spend that 3 months beforehand supporting that egg growth and that recruitment, the more likely we are that there are more applicants who might all be appropriate for the job. So we might end up with more.
Yeah, which is always a good place to be. Yeah. Now, talking about when they run out, because that's always, I guess, a concern. Yep. We hear about all this recruitment. Okay, we're 100 start. Am I going to run out?
So that's kind of what menopause is, sort of, pretty much. Is when you run out. And I guess I get a lot of questions from people about, well, if I do IVF, aren't we taking more of my eggs, then menopause will come sooner.
Yep.
But actually, we're not taking eggs from that quiet pool of eggs that are sitting in our ovaries doing nothing when we do IVF. We're taking eggs from the group, the cohort, the whatever word you want to use, the group that were already growing up towards an egg collection, towards an ovulation, that we sort of jolly along with the injections. So Can we run out? Yes, that's what menopause is. And usually on average in Australia, that happens around 50. For some people, it happens earlier than that. But by the time you get to 42, 44, statistically speaking, you haven't run out of eggs, but of those that are left, they're less likely to be chromosomally normal, and they're less likely to have the resilience to cope with those first 3 days of development that are all important. And I'm sure we'll get to it as we talk more, but those first 3 days of development of an embryo rely completely on the power provided by the egg. And if the egg doesn't have that power because it hasn't coped very well in the 3 months before it was ovulated, then it's not going to have enough resilience or health or power to be able to power those first 3 days of development.
Yeah.
So the older we get, the fewer we have, and the less resilient they are. So it's not, and the less likely they are to be chromosomally normal. So it's not that we run out at 40, it's just that we probably don't have an abundance at that point. So it's much harder to get the one that's going to do what you want.
And we need to support that recruitment process, even that's more right. So in our 40s, it becomes more important. Yeah. So we've talked all about eggs. Obviously, there's two people involved in this. Well,
yes.
There's an egg and the sperm. What yep. about sperm? What's the difference? Egg, we've got lots. We ovulate each month. What are yep. we looking at with sperm?
So if sperm are made in the testes, little boys build the factories to make sperm somewhere between 4 and 8 years old. They're not born with the sperm making factories. They build them in their childhood. And then once they build them, they kind of just sit there doing nothing until they hit puberty. But once they hit puberty, they start up the production lines. And production lines for making sperm, like as women, we batch cook. So we have, you know, a cohort and a group that go together towards 1 month. Guys are much more like a production line at a car factory. There's constantly round cells rolling on the start of the production line, and there's constantly sperm rolling off the other end of the production line. That production line, rather coincidentally, also takes about 3 months from beginning to end. And there are literally millions of these production lines within the testes. So the testes are like a great big garden hose all rolled up. And if you unraveled it and sliced the garden hose and looked down the middle of it, the sperm are produced in the wall of that garden hose, and the production lines go in like this. And then the sperm go into the hole in the middle, and they make their way down to the warehouse. So they come through the factories, and then they make their way to the warehouse, which is the epididymis, and they sit in the warehouse until the delivery shunt happens. So there are constantly sperm being made. The quality of the sperm is dependent on a number of things. Firstly, how the factory was built in the first place, how the blueprint was created as to how to make the sperm in the first place. So that's dependent on childhood exposures to diet and lifestyle factors, and you know, exposures to toxins and all that kind of thing. And then it's also dependent on lifestyle factors once the factories are actually running. You know, is the heating turned up too high? Are the workers being fed nicely? Is everybody happy on the production line to be producing good quality sperm? And then are the warehouse people functioning nicely, and, you know, the temperature settings all right in the warehouse, in the epididymis? And then in the delivery system, is the you know, are there roadblocks on the delivery driveway? Are there, you know, an actual ejaculate only contains 5% of an ejaculate is sperm, and the rest of it is added along the way. And what gets added along the way can impact the quality of the sperm, and it impacts aspects of the sperm that we can't see in a semen analysis. So we can do a semen analysis and go, everything's fine, tick. And that kind of frustrates me probably as much as it frustrates you, because there's so many aspects to a semen analysis that we can't see, or to sperm functionality that we can't see in a semen analysis. So all of these lifestyle factors that we talk about for the women and these 90 days beforehand, or the egg producers, are just as important for the sperm producers, and particularly in those 3 months while they're you know, being created on their production lines.
And also to look at the seam analysis, I often get the husbands, I've been ticked off, I'm all good. Yep. And as you know, 4% normal sperm is ticked off is good. And so that means 96% of them are duds. And look, you can be, as with all test results, you know, you can be in the bottom line of everything, and that's not ideal for getting a healthy.
Well, you know, and you probably do it too, I'm sure. When it's the final number that's important, not all Absolutely. The little numbers along the way. So
yeah,
you know, the World Health Organization say 15 million sperm per mil, 50% motile, roughly 40% progressively motile and 4% normal forms. Normal. So if you're sitting there, the World Health Organization consider that to be a fertile sample, which,
yep.
you know, the final number, if you've got 2 mils and 15 million sperm per mil and 50% of them are motile and 4% of them are morphologically normal, that final number is only 1.5 or something, like it's quite low. Mm. Yet I had a client the other day who had 76 million sperm per mil and, you know, 68% motility and blah, 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 but his morphology was only 2%. So they said to do IVF with ICSI. And I said, I question that, because your final number is actually 7, not 1.
Yeah, because you got so many.
So, okay, maybe you do need to have IVF, but I would say that maybe we just do standard IVF, not ICSI. And they did do that, and they got really good fertilization and they got beautiful embryo development. And, you know, we need to be as least invasive as we possibly can.
And look at the person, not just the lab results and tick you off as, you're okay, you're normal, but let's look into what's happening. And as you said, all those other parameters. I mean, I've had husbands come to me smoking, but the semen analysis looks okay, so I'm sure I'm fine. I'm like, no. This affects your sperm, regardless of whether they've ticked you off as okay. Smoking is going to affect
and you know, we get great fertilization, so it's not a sperm problem. That's one aspect of sperm, but also what's happening after day 3? Oh, they all die at day 3. Okay, well, let's go back and talk about sperm again, shall we, because you know, that's really important.
Exactly. Well, we're going to talk about, but let's talk about that window, because I find that's something that people don't understand either, the development process. You know, from that embryo, fertilization, blastocyst, embryo, how does that progress? What's the timeline? What are we looking at in an optimal progression?
Yep. So the very long answer, there is a very long answer to that.
That's a very loaded
eight
question.
8 hours. But let's not do that.
No, let's do the short version.
Short version. Sperm and egg meet. They need to meet within 24 hours of the sperm being ovulated. Sorry.
I was nearly going to correct you on that. I think you meant the egg, but yeah.
No, I think I meant the egg. 24 hours of the egg being released from the ovary.
Yep.
The sperm need to meet that egg within 24 hours. Now, I suggest, and this is purely anecdotal and only, there's absolutely zero peer-reviewed scientific data to back it up that I've found, but I believe that it actually needs to be 12 hours, not 24.
I've even heard people say 3, so I'm with you on that. Let's get it early. Yep.
Especially the older you get. So I once heard a fertility specialist describe the egg a little bit like Beyonce, and if we know Beyonce is going to be arriving on the red carpet at 7 p.m., we don't want to wait to get a phone call from her doorman to say, I'm just about to open the door and let her out. We actually want to be standing on the side of that red carpet at 6 a.m. to get a good photo.
Yeah.
So, and that's exactly how it is with sperm. If that egg is she is a princess. If she comes out and there's nobody waiting for her, I reckon she goes, well, stuff you all, I'm out of here. I'm not playing this game. And you're done. So waiting until you see an LH rise on an ovulation test strip or a basal body temperature increase or any of those things, waiting until then is too late. You need to be making sure that there are sperm sitting there waiting for the egg when it arrives. So egg and sperm meet within 24 hours of the egg being released. Fertilization is a process. It's not a single event. It's a process of chemical reactions that have to happen in a certain order. It's like what we call a cascade event. So this one has to happen in order for that one to happen, in order for that one to happen, in order for, you know, and so on and so forth. And if any one of those steps doesn't happen, the whole process is out. So fertilization, it's not a matter of just putting sperm and eggs together and fertilization is going to happen. It's not a matter of just pushing the sperm in there and then it happens. It is a chemical process that needs to happen for the formation of the egg and the sperm to make a fertilized egg. Then once the egg is fertilized, we expect the first division, so the first cellular division, to happen within 24, 36 hours of fertilization. And then, so day zero is egg collection, day one is fertilization check. Day two, we expect to see an embryo between 2 and 6 cells, ideally 4. On day three, we expect to see an embryo between 6 and 10 cells, ideally 8. By day 4, those cells in that embryo have started to compact and talk to each other a whole lot more. It's very hard to judge or to score or make any decisions about day 4 embryos because they just look like a big blob. And then on day 5, we expect to see that that embryo has started to form a little hole in the middle that fills up with fluid, and we call it cavitating. So we expect to see that embryo cavitating and those cells starting to turn into two very distinct different cell types, one of which will go on to become the placenta. One group of cells will go on to become the placenta and the amniotic sac and all of those bits, and the other group of cells will go on to become the baby. So we need to see those two very distinct different cell types, and there need to be enough of each, and they need to be evenly spaced. You know, there's a lot of aspects to judging an embryo on day 5 or 6. And at that point, when it's got those two different distinct cell types, at that point, it's called a blastocyst.
Yep. Yep. And so when do we go from blastocyst to embryo? Where, what are we looking at there?
So from embryo to blastocyst happens between day 3 and day 5.
Yeah.
So, you know, day 4, you might have heard the word morula or morula, or people pronounce it lots of different ways. I always call it a morula. on day 4, and morulas are ugly and weird and hard to judge, so we kind of tend to leave them alone.
Yeah.
And the embryo is doing a lot on day 4. It's doing a lot of things, and it's sort of, I love to use really simplified analogies, because I think, you know, you go from sitting on your sofa watching Big Bang Theory on Netflix to sitting in a doctor's office and they're using all these massive words, and you're like, well, I didn't study biology at school, so suddenly I feel stupid.
And you don't ask the questions, and obviously often there is,
you don't want to feel stupid.
Exactly. That's the hard part.
And, you know, I get a lot of lawyers and accountants and really intelligent people going, I don't like feeling stupid. And I'm sitting in these doctor's appointments going, pretending I understand, but I feel really dumb. Can you help me? Absolutely. Yeah. I like to bring things back to really simple analogies. So in a morula, it's kind of like they're all sitting around going, rightio, we need to do something here, fellas. And they get talking, and all the embryos, the cells within the embryo push up against each other, and there's a lot more communication channels. It's like they've all pulled their chairs up to the table and gone, hey, apparently we're making a baby here. What do we need to do? Well, I'm going to go over this way and I'm going to be an ear. Okay, cool. Well, I'll come with you and I'll be the eye and I'll be the nose, and we'll go on and grow that bit. Rightio, well, you guys have got that bit sorted. I'm going to go over here and I'm going to start building this placenta to try and support you guys in doing what you're doing. So that's kind of what's happening on day 4. It's kind of like a meeting of the minds to decide what the next plan is. Yeah. So it's quite a big step on day 4. And up to day 3, it's really just a process of replicating DNA and dividing, replicating DNA, dividing. And that is all powered by the power packs that came from the egg, which were all grown in the 3 months before the egg was ovulated. Mm-hmm. So those power packs were all grown, and then they get used up in those first 3 days. And by day 4, there's enough copies of the paternal DNA, the DNA that came from the sperm, there's enough copies of that now and enough copies of mum's to come together and go, hey, you know what, we're going to take over now. We're going to do this. There's enough of us here now. It's kind of like when your parents get old and the kids go, we've got this now. We're going to take over and we're going to manage it from here. And so that's where the embryonic genome turns on day 4. And that's why a lot of embryos stop developing at that point. So a lot of embryos will get to day three and then they go, this is a bit hard. I can't do this. There's either not enough copies of dad's DNA or dad's DNA, when they unpacked it and tried to use it, it's all jumbled, like a computer that got fragmented and we can't understand the information. It's all there, but we don't understand it. And it all just gets a bit too hard. So lots of embryos stop at day three and don't make it to blastocyst because of difficulty with the DNA that's provided often from the sperm, but not always from the sperm, sometimes from the egg.
But it can be from the sperm. I think there is that, as you said, there is that assumption that, well, they were fertilized, so I did my job. It's obviously an egg issue, when that's not necessarily the case. They are both involved in that day three onwards progression.
And the other thing I say to a lot of my clients is, if all your embryo, if I'm in managing a lab and I have a patient in my lab and all of, or patients' embryos, material in my lab, and all of their material, all of their embryos fall over on day three, the very first thing I'm going to do as lab manager is go back and make sure that the first 24 hours that that egg was in my care, all the temperature stages were right, all of the incubators were right, all of the tubing that we used was right, all of the test tube blocks that we used were at the right temperature, that no one else who was collected on the same day whose embryos are at the same stage had the same problem. Because embryos falling over between, you know, around about day two, day three, can be a product of stress on embryos, stress on eggs in the first 24 hours before they even met the sperm. So we need to look at that time. As a lab manager, I need to look at that time and rule that out. And once I'm confident that that's okay and that everyone else who was collected on that day who has embryos that are the same age are fine, then I know that it's not a lab issue. Then I turn to the sperm yep. DNA fragmentation.
And that's another report, obviously, you can run alongside the sperm analysis, which I do with a lot of my patients, but I always then go on, there are things we cannot test for. And so getting that healthy report is not necessarily a tick that everything's hunky-dory.
But even if you do a sperm DNA fragmentation test, that only tells you about that ejaculate.
Of course.
And that ejaculate is only a product of the time immediately before it. So we don't know what you did the next day or the day before that didn't impact that ejaculate, that might impact tomorrow's or next week's, or, you know. So the treatment for sperm DNA fragmentation is simple. It's all diet and lifestyle. It's all your bag. It is 100% Tasha Jennings bag. So if we are doing 3 months prep for egg quality and preparation, you'd be insane if you didn't also do the prep for the sperm, in the feeling that it might be, there may be a sperm DNA fragmentation, and we don't want to get to day three of this IVF cycle that we've been building up to for 6 months and discover that and then have to go back and do that for 3 months. Why would we not just do that anyway?
And it's about creating the, as I said, my job is always, I love the 90 days. So we're definitely right on the same page there. My job is not just creating a pregnancy. It's creating a healthy pregnancy and a healthy baby. And that's, I did a great podcast with Professor Adam Watkins, if you want to find that one on my website. But in his research is showing that not only does sperm health affect, yes, your chances of conception, we know that is a given, but it affects the lifelong health of your future baby. You are passing on the best DNA possible.
Babies born from fathers who smoked in the preconception period have a higher incidence of childhood cancers. So you're focusing right now, your listeners are focusing right now on getting two lines on a pregnancy test. They want to get pregnant. Like, yeah, cool, we want you to get pregnant, but we also want you to have a healthy pregnancy, and we also don't want to hear from you when you're taking your two-year-old to hospital because they've got leukemia. So can we actually get this right? And it's easy. It's not, you know, you don't have to spend $7,000 buying some ridiculous thing. You don't have to have some massively crazy lifestyle change that's going to impact everything in your life. There are really simple things you can do that are going to make a big difference to the health of your child. And as I said, if you have a baby girl, by the time she's born, she's already got her fertility lockdown.
Yeah.
You know, and her eggs are done. That's it. And if you have a little boy, when he's four, between the age of 4 and 8, if you make these changes now and their whole of life changes, when that little boy is 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you're going to know what you need to be doing or avoiding or helping. It's going to be part of your natural life anyway to help him build the right factories so that he can have babies one day too. You know, this red book here, and I'm sure you've got it too. I can't see it on your shelf there, but I'm sure it's there. It's called Countdown.
Here somewhere.
Called yep. Countdown by Shanna
yes.
Scott.
Yes. That'll be there somewhere. It's fine.
Might be right up behind your head. But she says by the year 2045, there won't be enough sperm left and we will have, everyone will have to have fertility treatment to conceive. Now, my son will only be 28 by then. I like to think, he's 5 now, I like to think that I'm helping him build his sperm factories right now so that that's not going to be a problem later. And I'm conditioning him so that his jocks are always just a little bit too big and his doesn't have bubble baths. Why would you have a stinky bubble bath full of all that synthetic fragrance? And
throw them out as soon as I see. I've yes. given them as presents all the time. No, throw that blue
sorry,
bath bomb
have
in the
bin. Sorry, I know it looks pretty, but you can't. Let me tip it out and we'll fill it up with water and you can play with it in the bath, but you're not having that other crap. You know, all of those kinds of things are all part of conditioning our kids so that when they get to 25, 28, 35 and they're ready to have children, they don't put plastic in the microwave. They they wouldn't even think of putting plastic in the microwave. All of those kinds of things are all part of future fertility as well as this. So for people who are trying to conceive now, yes, absolutely, we want you to get pregnant. But if your child turns 10 in April or in July, doesn't really matter. But let's spend a few months now preparing all of that stuff so that when you do get that child, they're the healthiest they can possibly be.
And you're improving their fertility. And I've even have a recent patient, 41-year-old, nearly 40, turning 42. And I told her we need to pause for 3 months. And that's so hard to do. She didn't want to hear that. Yeah. Because all the message is I'm running out of time. I had a patient in tears the other day because, you know, her specialist had told her the stats and that she was almost negligent for not doing IVF. You know, 3 months later, both of those had a positive pregnancy test. And one has since gone on to have a healthy baby that I've seen through breastfeeding. And so that we're doing that three-month prep, it's not going backwards. It's not treading water. It's not wasting time. It's not ramping up the biological clock. It's actually supporting all the processes we've talked about.
Fertility doesn't just turn off one day. It doesn't just switch off. And 3 months is not going to make any difference to your AMH or your whatever. 6 months, maybe. 9 months, maybe. Statistically speaking, if we look at statistics, yes, statistically speaking, 42 is not a great age to be trying to conceive.
Yep.
But statistics come from whole populations, which include everybody. Like everyone. And so not the people who are focusing on their nutrition and their lifestyle factors and all of those kinds of things. And it doesn't, like I keep saying, it doesn't mean you have to go and join a gym and lose 20 kilos and all. It's nothing to do with that stuff. It's to do with, as you would know, and I'm packing your bag for you now, but it's all the metabolism, it's all the nutrition. Yeah. And I, as an embryologist, I see that in the eggs. You know, 20 years ago we just went, oh well, they've got dodgy eggs, bad luck, there's nothing you can do. And now we know that sending them off to spend 3 months preparing those raw materials can have a massive impact to the quality of the embryos that we're able to create in the lab.
And I love speaking to the embryologists and seeing that improvement. And when we're looking at these 3 months, as you say, it's not about being absolutely perfect. You know, I find that that is too stressful. And I find that's why getting support from someone like yourself or myself, because people come to me, I don't know about you, in Google overwhelm, and they are absolutely stressed out. They're nearly eating nothing because they're too scared to eat anything that hasn't been picked from a tree and it's 100% organic. The stress levels are through the roof. That is not what we're talking about. That is not the level of perception you need to create a pregnancy, and it actually can be detrimental to your own mental health.
And I often talk to my clients about the symphony of your hormones. And, you know, we tend to focus on estrogen and progesterone, and my progesterone levels here, and what are my AMH levels, and all of these things when we're talking fertility. And then when we're talking nutrition, we're focusing on insulin levels and estrogen, all, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But I talk about the whole symphony. You know, if we're adding, if we've got cortisol playing, you know, the microphone turned right up on your cortisol and right down on your dopamine and your serotonin, the symphony sounds shit. It's not going to work. Sorry, am I allowed to use words like that in your podcast?
Who knows?
I normally use much worse words, so it's good. You know, I'm doing a good job. You know, the symphony's not going to play right. Mm. We need the whole symphony playing right. And, you know, we both bang on all the time about endocrine disrupting chemicals and the impact they have. If you have a lot of exposure to things that are interrupting how your hormones work, it's like someone turning around, running around your symphony, turning microphones on and off. And then you're sitting in the symphony trying to listen to it and saying, this symphony sounds like shit. It's no good. And, you know, everyone's banging on about balancing hormones. And, you know, on the one hand, all the naturopaths are saying we need to balance our hormones. And on the other hand, all the doctors are saying there's no such thing as balanced hormones because they're always out of balance. Yes, they're both right, because they are always out of balance. They're a symphony, and we need the percussion to be playing and the wind instruments and the, you know, everything to be playing properly so it all plays. And so we need the nutrition and the exercise and the all of these factors to be playing right. And there is no one formula that gets it right. It's just a matter of trying to do better, not best, and just, you know, work on trying to get the whole symphony playing.
And I love that symphony analogy, because it is moving. It's not a static thing. We are not a sum of our blood tests. I love blood tests. I do love, you know, but there are information that is helping us support you. They are not a measure of this is you. As you said, the sperm is constantly evolving. The eggs are constantly, everything is constantly moving. Yep, so we need to look at the big picture. So one thing, just coming back to the, I guess, the story of the the egg and sperm, and obviously we've got that beautiful blastocyst, we've got that separation there, the placental cells, implantation. Like, that's a question I often get asked. When does it happen? How does it happen? You know, what can I do if I sit in the toilet wrong? Is it going to fall out? Okay, what's that next step?
So a lot of people get confused between embryo transfer and implantation.
Yes.
And they'll say, I had an implantation on the 15th of June. And I'm like, did you have your embryo transfer on the 15th of June? Well, no, they implanted the embryo. No, they don't implant the embryo. They don't actually scratch a little spot and plant it like a seed. They just put it in the space. Now, when I was at university a long time ago, 25 years ago, we had an amazing lecturer who described implantation like the lunar landing module. So when they flew to the moon and that lunar landing module went down to land on the moon, it had to land in a certain spot, and it had to land up the right way, and it had to land in a certain way. Otherwise, if it landed crooked or upside down or in the wrong spot and fell in a hole, it wasn't going to work. And the same goes for embryo implantation. So we do the embryo transfer, and implantation itself is another one of those chemical cascade events. So it's not just landing and there we're done. It's a series of chemical reactions that have to happen in their cascade in the certain order. So we transfer the embryo back to the uterus in an embryo transfer. Your uterus is kind of like two sheets of corrugated iron sitting together. So once we put the embryo in there, it's in. It can't come out. The cervix is it's probably the cervix that's more like the two sheets of corrugated iron. The uterus is a little bit more open. But once those two bits are together like that, the embryo cannot fall out of there. Your cervix is completely separate to your urethra. So if you do a wee, you're not going to wee your embryo out. It's in a completely separate place. And implantation itself happens somewhere between day 5 and day 7, somewhere around there. There are some fascinating images of implantation in that book there. I won't get them.
Is that the green one? The embryo? No, no, no. Anyway, I've got a, yeah, anyway. we love fascinating pictures of of embryos.
This one is called A Child Is Born. Have you got that one?
I was going to say, I think I do. It looks different. No, Before We Are Born, mine one's called slightly different.
So this one is written by a guy called Lars Hamburger. And I had the privilege of sitting in the desk in front of him at the place where I worked in Sweden, in Vitrolife. And he signed this book for me, which I feel very privileged to have. But this is an embryo that's implanted here. So that's the embryo, and it's sort of got these little bits growing here. And for anyone who's listening, not watching the video, that's hard to see. But it's fascinating. The process of implantation is fascinating. So once the embryo is transferred to your uterus, take-home message, it can't fall out.
Yeah.
It either implants or it just gets resolved into the uterus and doesn't implant. I have had patients come back to me when I was working clinically who were using the progesterone crinone, you know, those crinone suppositories.
Yep.
They turn into little pearls once they've been in your vagina for a while.
Yeah.
They turn into little pearls. And she excreted one of these pearls or wiped and got one of these pearls and thought that her embryo had come out. Mm. But they're just the little pearls from the progesterone. Suppositories, but the embryo is too small for you to see at that point. It's too small for anyone to see. Even if it was sitting in a dish, we couldn't see it without a microscope. And what are the factors affecting whether it will implant? There's nothing that you can do or have done or could do differently that's going to make any difference to that. There are some recent studies about various different dietary things that you can eat during implantation. Macca's fries is not one of them.
I get that question too.
All the time. That one and pineapple core.
Pineapple core.
No, not going to make a difference.
No. I kind of get the theory behind pineapple core, but there is no evidence on it at all. But I don't get the Macca's chips is totally. I said, if you want to do it, if that's for go your for mental it. Health, you feel better, then go for it. So I don't see it as my ideal.
From the lab perspective, our message to patients after embryo transfer was always anything you want to do, do. Anything you're worried about doing or you wonder whether you should be doing it or not, don't do it.
Yeah.
Because the stress of worrying about it is actually more detrimental than the thing you're doing.
Yeah.
So if you're vacuuming the house and thinking, oh, I wonder if I should really be doing this, I probably shouldn't, don't do it.
Yeah.
If you're lying on the sofa thinking, oh, I really shouldn't be lying here, I should get up and do something, get up and do something. Like, don't worry about whether you should be doing it or not. Just don't do it.
These processes happen within our body all the time, and people are going about their daily life. So there isn't that concern. I know you want to wrap yourself in cotton wool, but it won't make much of a difference.
There is, scientifically speaking, there is absolutely nothing you can do in that interminable 2-week wait that's going to have any impact on the outcome. And if it doesn't, you know, I see a lot of girls who've had a PGS tested, so a genetically tested normal embryo transfer. I hate that word normal, but chromosomally normal embryo transferred that doesn't implant. And then they say, well, it must be me. I had this perfect embryo transplant. You know,
I get that too.
And everything was going fine until it came back to me and then it didn't implant.
Yeah.
Must be me. And that's a normal female thing to do, I think. We always blame ourselves and we feel like we should be able to control these things. But the reality is that PGS testing is not always right. Implantation is a multifactorial, massive chemical series of chemicals.
That is so important that I'm always explaining that, because I think there is such it was tested normal. I've done all the right things. I must have done something wrong for it not to work. And that is not the case.
No.
Yeah. So supporting your own health, you know, in that window. I love the study. Did you see the one that showed that women who were entertained by medical clowns had better outcomes after transfer? As I always say, whether we can replicate that one, I don't know. But I love it. Go do something fun. Watch a funny movie. I generally say veto housework.
There are actually a couple of studies that show that laughter in that time has an impact. Plan things that are going to be fun, plan catch-ups, plan things that are going to stop you from sitting around googling, wondering,
symptoms,
torturing yourself and symptom spotting. We all do it, you know, you can't stop, you know, my boob's a bit sore, maybe I have peed more times today, I don't know, maybe, you know, but
Yeah, but that 2 week wait is always going to be hard. I did one podcast with Professor Gemma Evans, and she was looking at dietary factors affecting uterine lining. So if you want the information about that, jump over and listen to her. But the ultimate, you know, answer is just do what you can in those 3 months. Enjoy yourself in the 2 week wait, and you've done everything you can in that.
And I would add into that, obviously, being an embryologist, during those 3 months, while you're doing all the prep for the raw materials, included in your preparation should be learning about the process of IVF so that you can manage your expectations for what's actually going to happen during that time. And we've covered that really in a sort of summary form today, but actually knowing how many eggs am I likely to get collected? What does that actually mean? How many of those eggs collected are likely to fertilize? What should I expect from the first 3 days of development? What's it going to look like? What's an egg collection? How do they actually do the egg collection? And what do the needles look like? And all of that kind of stuff. So that when you get to those appointments with your doctor and they're saying, no, we're going to do this, or we need you to just make this decision today, or we're going to change something else, your general knowledge is at a level where you don't feel like a half-wit sitting in those appointments, and you've done all your body and your lifestyle and dietary prep, but you've also gathered the information from a reliable source about what's actually going to happen, so that you can understand what's going on as it's happening.
And it helps you make informed decisions because, as I say, this is not really fact or fiction. This is an art. And what your specialist recommends, you may go to a different specialist who recommends something different. Are they right or wrong? No, they have a different art and different way of doing it. So if you're informed, you can ask those questions as to, okay, why are we doing it this way versus that way? And so I know you have some amazing resources, and you do take on a limited number of patients who you work with one-on-one. If people, I know people have loved this conversation, and I think it's so important, and this should be taught earlier to everyone. So please pass this on to friends who are trying to conceive to listen to this, so that everyone can have this understanding. They want to love Lucy, want to hear more. Where should we go?
So as you said, I do take on a very small number of one-on-one clients in bundles, but I can't see everyone all the time. So I have created a couple of programs online. My big one is IVF WTF, which is releasing 4 times a year. So jump on my website and see when you can jump into the next one of those. And I've got one coming next week, but I don't know timing. So that is going to be released 4 times a year. And that one includes all of those questions I just answered, plus a whole lot more. And I've got a few friends who've contributed various other things to that. So there's a whole lot of information in that program. There's also one for earlier along the journey. So Fertility 101, all the stuff you should have learned at school. You can sit down and go through that and go, okay, how does my body actually work? What should I be looking for, and how do I work out what questions to ask my doctor and that kind of thing. And then there's a third one called Toxins and Fertility, which talks all about what actually are endocrine disrupting chemicals. Are they fact or fiction? There's science-backed referenced material in there about the impact that these toxins are having on your whole of life. Hormones are not just for fertility, they're for everything, sleep, stress, brain fog, all the things. And you can easily reduce your exposure to these if you know what you're looking for and how to slot that into your life. So that program's on my website as well.
Excellent. And your website, for everyone who's listening and can't go to the show notes just yet,
twolinesfertility.com.au. So T-W-O, lines, so my surname, fertility.com.au.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk to us today. I always love, I think we'll chat for another 2 hours about, about fertility.
I've been boring people at dinner parties for 20 years.
Oh, I get so excited when someone's interested and then I have to realise not everyone's as fascinated as I am. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And
pleasure.
Head to Lucy's website if you want more information. And I will join you in the next episode. Bye for
now. Sasha, thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Conceive Baby podcast. To help you move forward on your journey to pregnancy, I've created your free fertility checklist for you. This checklist provides simple swaps you can make that can have a significant impact on your chances of conceiving and carrying your healthy baby. So be sure to head to conceivebaby.com.au/checklist to download your free fertility checklist today.